Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Well, it's Monday morning, and that means, as always, it's time for All Things Political. It's an hour of what's making headlines around the state, the nation, and the world. And, of course, we're happy to be joined this morning by our guest analyst. Today, it is Charles Franklin, a UW-Madison political science professor. And we're always happy to hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome this hour. You can tell us about what you're wondering about in the news, what you've been following. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Professor Charles Franklin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always good to be here.
Well, of course, news doesn't stop for the weekend. We've been seeing that over and over lately as the news cycles have been just tremendous. This weekend, we've had updates in the airstrikes in Libya, the nuclear reactors in Daiichi, and, of course, the budget battle here in Wisconsin. Why don't we start with Japan, if you will? And you know, the world has been very tense about the nuclear reactors there that they've been trying to cool in Daiichi. And there has been some progress over the weekend, but there's also been a setback yesterday. What have you been following there?
The biggest news was this morning the apparent smoke or vapors rising from one of the reactors, which implied a setback, but again, coupled with the report that the radiation levels were not elevated. You know, one of the things that's been frustrating to the world, I think, and surely to the Japanese, is the lack of clear information about what exactly is going on at that plant, what are the radiation levels, how are they actually measured. So there's been a lot of frustration there and terrific difficulty in getting them under control. You know, I think there are six reactors at this one site, and at least four of them are having serious problems. So it's harder than if you just had a single reactor that was a problem. Here you have to deal with multiple ones all essentially right next to each other.
And one of the frustrations, I guess, slash worry, is that the longer it takes, the worse the odds get for getting it solved in the least catastrophic fashion.
I think there's certainly a question of how long this might go on. If you want a silver lining in this, it is that, at least again apparently, levels of radiation have not been terribly elevated. The contrast with Chernobyl, the worst international nuclear accident, levels of radiation there were considerably higher, a lot higher. You know, the other side of the Japan story, of course, is the recovery from the earthquake and the tsunami. You know, for Americans, this is not unlike the New Orleans hurricane in 2005, and how the Japanese are responding to that, how fast they are, and the difficulties of dealing with the devastation and human needs there at the same time that you have this reactor difficulty. So they're really two parallel stories, but the human disaster, I think, is the one that probably will have considerable domestic consequences in Japan as well.
Well, I think I read over the weekend that the death toll is around 18,000, above 18,000 already.
Yes, passing the previous highest death toll from an earthquake, but with large numbers of people still missing. You know, we've had reports of substantial numbers of bodies washed out to sea and things like that. But it's also a relatively, at least by Japan scale, a relatively large area that was inundated by the tsunami as well as the earthquake damage. And so, you know, we really are seeing three different disasters all at once there, the nuclear, the earthquake, and the tsunami. And the Japanese reaction is divided among all of those.
Well, and some troubling news coming out over the weekend is the finding that there have been levels of radiation that have been too high found in spinach and milk, among other things.
My impression, based on the aftermath of Chernobyl, is that low levels of radiation will be found in a wide variety of places and locations. But again, our confidence in this would be a great deal higher if the Japanese nuclear authorities had seemed to be more forthcoming and more consistent in their reporting of what was going on at the reactor. At least for a non-specialist like me, I'm not a nuclear engineer, I don't even play one on radio, but it would have been more reassuring in a way if accurate readings of radiation releases were clear, as opposed to what we've mostly heard, radiation levels are elevated, but nothing to worry about, and that after a while becomes less reassuring.
What about fears, you know, over here on this side in America? I've been hearing just anecdotally that there have been runs on iodine tablets here in Madison, for instance.
Again, I'm not an expert on this, and I don't want to pretend to be one, but what I hear from the experts are that those fears here are vastly exaggerated, that the dilution of radiation will be so great that we're really not looking at health impacts in the U.S. A detectable level of radiation is really a very low amount of radiation because we are so good at detecting it.
Well, to move over to another big news story, closer to home this time, the budget battle. There was some big news breaking on Friday about the judge issuing a temporary restraining order. I don't know if it's temporary or restraining order about the budget bill's collective bargaining aspect. What about that?
Indeed, the story that just really won't wind down. So Judge Sumi here in Madison issued a restraining order in the publication of the budget repair bill. And so, in effect, what that does is put the bill on hold until the judge can hold hearings, essentially a trial, to hear the evidence and make a decision based on the substance of the case. And that's not to begin until the 29th, I believe it is, so a little ways off. In the meantime, this puts the bill on hold. Now, remember, Secretary of State La Follette said that he was not going to publish the bill until the 25th in any case. So we're looking at least at the moment, at a few days delay in implementation rather than much longer. But the judge has set aside, I believe, 3 days for the hearings and the presentation of the case. So this will stretch into April if no further resolution is found. Now, I have not seen a report yet this morning, but our understanding on Friday afternoon was that the state would proceed with an appeal of that restraining order. And that's a little complicated because the case hasn't been settled. The appeals court has to grant permission for an appeal.
I see.
But under the circumstances, I guess we're likely to see that granted. So we'll basically see parallel paths here. One will be an appeal to the state appeals court, who could set aside the temporary restraining order, but still that would go back to Judge Sumi's court for hearings on the merits of the case, or they could let the temporary restraining order stand and pending the final outcome of the case in Judge Sumi's court. So this is going to stretch on for a little while, and now Judge Sumi opened the door in her in court on Friday by saying that there was nothing in her order that prevented the state legislature from giving proper notice under the open meetings law and going ahead and passing the bill again. Senator Fitzgerald has suggested that there's little interest in doing that. So my understanding at this moment anyway is that the legislature and the governor are not thinking of trying to pass the bill yet again.
Now, why wouldn't they?
Why
would they put that aside right now rather than letting it get clogged up in the courts, which could drag on quite a while?
Well, I think the longer it drags on, the more pressure there might be to bring it back into the legislature. But I think the political calculation is a fairly reasonable one, that if you expect to win in the courts, it's easier to go ahead and win in the courts than it is to bring the legislature back into session and have to go through this whole thing again. So if you win in the courts, you didn't have to do that. If you lose in the courts, as Judge Sumi ruled or said on Friday, you haven't really lost anything. You can still go back and pass the bill again. So I think from that point of view, the governor and the Republican leadership have a pretty good reason for not wanting to go ahead and have to pass it yet again, assuming they believe that they'll end up with a favorable ultimate ruling. Now, that's second-guessing. Who knows what the courts will ultimately decide? And if Judge Sumi does rule, possibly either way, there's likely to be an appeal from either side as well.
Well, I read a couple of places in the papers on Friday that this was being reported, at least, as a major setback for Governor Walker. And it sounds as though he's got lots of different paths through this thing. But is there a political price tag on this for him?
Well, there's the political price tag is one that, unlike Walmart, keeps rising rather than falling, if we believe the advertising. The longer it takes to put the passage of this bill behind us and move on to the next step, which is itself going to be very divisive, which is the budget for the next 2 years, which we'll be debating from now until at least the end of June. The longer this one drags out, the more it focuses attention on the current divisiveness rather than moving on to the next topic. So I think there's no question that the governor and the GOP leadership would rather have this behind us and be moving ahead. But I think the other side of the story is that Democrats have now returned at least one of those Democrats is now speaking of staying for any votes on this. And if Tim Cullen from Janesville, and if other Democrats decide that they've exhausted the usefulness of trying to block a vote entirely, or for that matter, now that the bill has been amended so that it doesn't deal with fiscal issues, the quorum issue is removed altogether anyway, then I think there's no question that the bill can pass the legislature a second time if it needs to. If the governor and the leadership decide that it's costing them too much to have it delayed, then they always have that as an alternative to come back to.
Now, what about the recall elections that are well underway across the state in the cases of both Democrats and Republicans? Is there any chance, do you think, that letting this budget bill work its way through the courts, for instance, would take so long that we would have different players in seat?
Sure. I'd be surprised if this doesn't. I'd be very surprised if we wait that long to get this current budget repair bill, settled. For one thing, the whole point of the bill was in part save some money in the current fiscal year, and so there's got to be some interest in actually getting those savings. And those were supposed to kick in April paychecks for state workers. And public notice here, of course, I am a state worker as a UW-Madison employee, though as a faculty member, I do not have a union representation. And so there is some issue about the timing of it, that the longer it stretches out, the more it fails to achieve some of the budget savings that were intended for it. As for the recall elections, the schedule for them is rather flexible. It's not like our usual November elections where we have a date certain, or this upcoming April 5th election where we know exactly when it'll be. And so the exact dates of the recall elections are yet to be settled, and they may very well scatter out across different election days through the summer. So that's quite a ways off still.
So I read an article in the Washington Post over the weekend that was reporting that there was a national GOP polling firm in the state that was testing some hardcore anti-union messages to see how voters would respond to different sort of lines. For instance, that how would you feel if you knew that Alberta Darling, for instance, had received death threats, things of that nature. And the thrust of the article was really that this is an indication of just how high the stakes are for these recall elections nationally. How big a deal do you think the recalls are going to be on the national stage?
I think they're very important, and the fact that outside groups are spending considerable money on both the pro-union and the anti-union side is an example of the stakes being important in other states, not just in Wisconsin. The kind of polling that was being done to test messages is typical of all polling firms, both Democratic and Republican, where a poll is used to ask a question phrased one way and then ask the question phrased a different way, sometimes for different halves of the sample. So you split the sample in half randomly and ask about death threats on the one side, and on the other side maybe you ask about a different issue. And the difference between them tell you something about how effective each of those messages was in pushing voters one way or the other. So that is, I think, completely normal polling and political activity.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you have this particular firm, which is one of the best in the business, and no doubt one of the more expensive ones as well, is indicative of the fact that gearing up for these campaigns, people on the GOP side are certainly taking them very seriously. Democrats would have to gain a net of 3 Senate seats out of the 8 Republican-held seats while potentially having to hold on to all of their Democratic seats in order to change control of the state Senate. And so that's a bit of a stretch. We've certainly never seen any precedent for flipping 3 state Senate seats between elections here in Wisconsin. But the possibility of doing that is enough to very much engage the folks that want to protect the Republican majority here and want Governor Walker to be able to continue with his agenda. So the result of that is big money being spent on polls and message testing.
Do you think that Wisconsin and what's unfolding here has changed the national conversation for what we're going to see going into the 2012 elections?
I think we've put the issue of state unions and, in the broader context, union bargaining rights much more prominently on the public agenda than they were even last fall. But we're certainly not alone. You can easily point to other states that have moved in this direction. Ohio, Indiana, Tennessee are all pursuing elements like this. And what an interesting development, Alabama a year ago preceded us in saying that the union dues would not be deducted from state workers' paychecks.
Hmm.
Just on Friday, we saw a federal court there overturn that law, saying that workers had a right to designate deductions from their paychecks if they wanted to. Now, that's a federal case, and it's in Alabama, so it does not directly apply in Wisconsin. But it's interesting that that element of whether you can have union dues deducted, even if you're not required to join a union, has been an issue in that other state, and now we could indeed see similar litigation going forward here, with at least one example in that Alabama case of a federal court siding with the unions.
This is Monday Morning's All Things Political. I'm Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn. And our guest this morning is Charles Franklin, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we open the phone lines now for you and your questions and comments about the latest headlines in the news for this weekend and the past week. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can always shoot us an email, too. It's talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this morning. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. And coming up next hour, we'll hear from a guest who tells us that everything we've been told about sweeteners is wrong. We'll be talking about the differences between sugar and high fructose corn syrup. And after 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller talks with his guests about how to work your way back into warmer weather sports and activities while avoiding injury. It's All Things Political this hour, and we're joined by Charles Franklin, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we'll go ahead and take our first phone call now. We have Chrissy joining us from Madison. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I am wondering, how come this bill is considered to not do with anything fiscal when it very much decided fiscal matters for the people who work for the state? It definitely determined what I can and cannot do with my money and how much I will get. And I'm thinking, and it comes out as a plus, according to Dr. Walker, or Dr. Walker, oh my God, how much it will help the state. So it is definitely fiscal. And I think, how could he pass that with that ruling about no fiscal if that's really what it was about?
Yes, this is one of the more confusing aspects of the whole thing, and in fact is part of a separate court case questioning whether the fiscal issue is really true or not. Let me give you my best understanding of it, but ultimately this may finally rest on a court for decision. The argument is that what is involved in the Constitution that requires the 20 senators to be present as the minimum quorum is anything that obligates the state to more debt or to increase taxes or to do a couple of other things like releasing a debtor from an obligation. And the argument is that this bill does none of those things, and in that very narrow sense of fiscal, is not fiscal under the requirements of Article 8, Section 8, which is the part that requires the 20 senator quorum. And so the governor's spokespeople argue that in that sense, this is not fiscal, even though in the common sense meaning of the word fiscal, it obviously has fiscal or monetary implications for state workers and indeed for the budget in terms of making the budget more sound rather than less sound. But the key point is, what is that legal meaning of fiscal? And the governor's office would argue strongly that by not increasing taxes, by not obligating the state to spend more, it passes that non-fiscal test and therefore doesn't require the 20 senators be present.
All right. Well, thank you for your question, Chrissy. And moving on to Lou with us from Green Bay. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I have one question. If the senators stay in the state this time, which apparently they're going to, does that make the Kathleen Falk complaint basically, would become a moot point then? Because even if, it was separated out of the budget repair bill, the collective bargaining, or not, they aren't going to boycott the vote again. So would that be a moot point,
right,
essentially?
I think if the Senate and the Assembly pass the bill again, as Judge Sumi suggested they could do, and if Democrats are present to provide the 20th or more than 20 quorum, then it seems to me that would indeed put aside the complaint that it dealt with fiscal issues and therefore would make it moot. But that would require the Senate to vote again, I believe. So, again, that case, the Kathleen Falk case, is now being delayed for quite a while as we move ahead with the temporary restraining order that was issued on Friday. So, again, we're going to wait a while to decide this.
All right. Well, thank you, Lou. And a question here from George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. Kind of a tactical political question. Assuming that there will be a recall effort to get the governor out of office in 2012. Do you think the chances for a successful recall would be more, say, if it would coincide with the April 2012 election as opposed to a November 2012 election?
Interesting.
Yeah, this is very interesting, and we're in completely uncharted waters here, right? Because nothing like this, certainly not on the scale of a gubernatorial recall, has ever happened. I think the best we can say from what we know about voting behavior is that November elections, especially a November election in 2012 with a presidential election going on at the same time, create the maximum voter turnout. So therefore, in a November election, you have more independents in the electorate, you have more young people, you have more people who are more peripheral to voting that don't always vote, but come out for the big election. So if we had a gubernatorial recall that was a standalone election, whether it was in April or any time other than November, the clear expectation would be that voter turnout would be lower, but that the people who do vote are more intense partisans, they're more engaged, they're more mobilized for that election. And from a tactical point of view of the two parties, that can play out either way. For Democrats and pro-union people right now, that degree of intensity that was visible in the Capitol demonstrations plays out pretty strongly. But a year from now, or more than a year from now, when a gubernatorial recall could occur, you're looking at a lot of strong Republicans and conservatives who are also likely to be mobilized and incidentally will be mobilized through the spring of 12 through the GOP primary, presidential primary. So I think it's very unclear which side might benefit from an earlier rather than a later recall. And in some ways we're getting ahead of ourselves. You still need over 500,000 signatures to force a gubernatorial recall. And that's an awful lot of signatures. We're, again, in uncharted waters of knowing how feasible that will be or not.
Looking at the recalls and their effect on all of this as well, let's say that the efforts to recall the GOP senators are not successful. Does that kind of take the wind out of the sails of a recall of Governor Walker as well?
Well, I think it would certainly suggest that the recall as a tactic is one that is difficult to pull off. There are certainly some voters who are unhappy with Governor Walker, but think that, you know, elections occur every 2 years. You can change the state legislature in the fall of 2012 if you want to, rather than the summer of 2011, and that might be a reason either not to vote or to vote to keep incumbents in office. And I think if that is an element in this, and either no one is recalled or less than enough to change the makeup of the Senate, then I think that is a bit of a setback to the opposition forces. But I would simply say that 2012 is a scheduled election where the Assembly is available for change. Half of the Senate is available for change. So there's plenty of opportunity either to replace Republicans with Democrats in a rejection of Governor Walker, or for Republicans to reassert their support for the governor. And after all, he won. The majority of both houses were controlled by Republicans after the last November election. And so it's certainly possible that when we hold the next round, either in the recalls or in November, that Governor Walker's forces can prevail and reassert that. So I think there's plenty of time for voters to have their say on this, I think is the best way to see it. Recalls are extraordinary. They're very hard to predict, and we don't have much experience with them. That's one way for voters to express their feelings. But we have a regular November 2012 election coming up, and that'll be another way to do that.
Well, thank you so much for your question, George. And we move to Dan with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Morning.
Morning.
I'm wondering if there really is such a thing as a local election anymore with individuals getting involved from other areas of the country as well as groups and all that money. It just makes me feel like we really don't have a such thing as local elections anymore. And I'm also wondering, because of that, are we going to be in a constant state of campaigning?
I think that's a great point, and you're right that local elections, at some levels of elections, remain local. Mayor's races probably are not bringing in a lot of national money right now. But our current controversy shows that when we have issues that apply across the board or that tap strong ideological groups or partisan groups, or in our case, issues that are also lively issues in other states, that we can see a tremendous amount of money coming in. We're likely to see that in advertising related to these recall elections. We're certainly seeing it in money both to support the recall petitions on both Democratic and Republican sides. And there's no question, I think, that we'll see a lot of independent expenditures on television advertising and get out the vote efforts. So, yes, there is a strong nationalization of this. A lot of it going back to the aftermath of, somewhat ironically, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms, which, while they restricted some kinds of soft money contributions to the parties, also opened the doors to the creation of these independent committees. And that followed by a series of Supreme Court rulings that have ruled that political expenditures and contributions are elements of free speech and therefore really can't be regulated very tightly, has really opened the floodgates to these national organizations sweeping into a state to support a candidate or a cause.
Well, speaking of going national, yeah, there's been speculation that Governor Walker is vying for a place at the table in the national part of the 2012 elections. What do you think about that? I know it's a little early to tell, but, you know.
Well, I think he has certainly earned a place at the table, but not necessarily a spot on the ticket. You know, we're in the silly season of presidential campaigns where all kinds of names are thrown around for president, and even more variety of names are thrown around for vice president. And I think it's way too early to have any sense that those are real possibilities, as well as the question of how long have you been in office before you move ahead up to the top of the ticket, though it was President Obama, ironically enough, who set the standard there for his short tenure in the Senate before he ran for president. So maybe it's a new world, and finishing a full term of office doesn't count anymore.
That's so last week.
Totally.
Finishing your term.
In fact, I've never run for anything, and I'm thinking of throwing my hand in the ring.
You probably got as good a shot as anybody.
I'd probably get zero votes because I wouldn't vote for me.
Let's see. Well, let's move on. Let's see. Jim in Milwaukee, you're with us next. Hi, Jim.
I want to talk about hypocrisy and reconciliation. And I think it's easy for progressive Democrats, for example, to look at Obama and see some things that are hypocritical, like clean coal, the situation with the guy from WikiLeaks being kept naked in his cell, and the fact that we're going after Libya, but we're not going after Saudi Arabia and the Bahrainian people that are oppressing their people. So we don't have any problem admitting that we have some faults, but my experience in dealing with a lot of conservatives is that you can't tell them anything about it, anything. And so that's kind of disappointing. And out of all the anger, you know, at crossing the line on attacking the unions in the state has resulted in people talking about economic boycotts and then conservatives speaking up self-righteously and saying that, well, you know, that would hurt people. Well, you know, it seems to me they should have thought about that when they voted for people that have policies that hurt the middle class and the poor in the first place. And so to people like this and to people who have the idea that we can reconcile with these people, I would just rename an old Clapton song and say that the song should say "Lay Down, Silly," because to think that we can expect to be treated as anything other than doormats if we don't do whatever kinds of resistance we can is, I think, is just irrational on our part.
All right. Well, thanks for your thoughts, Jim. And it's interesting what Jim brings up there about reconciliation, because it seemed as though after the shooting in Arizona that people were trying to play a little nicer in Washington, that there was a sense that at least it was good to put on a face of bipartisanship. Where do you think that stands now?
Oh, I think that was doomed from the beginning to be short-lived. You can see some marginal change in words or phrases that now are used less, but I think a hope of a more conciliatory politics really is not on the scene. I do think that one issue here happened when from their point of view at least, the unions see their very existence threatened by the changes in the budget repair bill. And so you could say that for the last 40 or 50 years, we've had a settled rules of the game in Wisconsin in which unions, including state unions, largely supported Democrats, business largely supported Republicans, both raised money and fought bitter battles in elections, but neither tried to go after the very existence of the other once they held office. And from the union's point of view, Governor Walker's bill is now that kind of threat to their very existence because it puts such restrictions on their bargaining rights and on their ability to collect dues that we really have seen a change in the rules of the game here. So Jim's point about what's at stake in this, I think, really does represent a change in normal political competition here in the state. These recalls are one example of it. The legal battles that I think are going to inevitably follow are one of them. And until we see some kind of either agreement on the rules of the game or the unions are simply made a less important element of Wisconsin politics and are replaced on the left by some other organizations that spring out of those ashes, I think we're going to see harder fought battles with harder feelings on both sides for quite a while into the future. Ultimately, I think these issues that we've been talking about for more than a month now here are really only going to be settled when one party or the other establishes that it really does have an electoral majority in the state, both in the legislature and in the governorship. And we may not do that. We may keep oscillating between the parties. We just don't know where that's going to end now.
Well, Wisconsin is supposedly a swing state, so.
Which we have been for a long time. And in fact, divided government has been more the rule than the exception since World War II at the state level, the governor and the two houses of the legislature. So it's possible we'll go back to that. Of course, that itself has its own drawbacks. President Obama had the phrase, elections have consequences, and that applies in this situation as well. The one thing you can say that is a good thing about one-party control of government is that Governor Walker and the GOP get to implement the policies they want for the state. And 2 years later, barring these recalls, voters get to vote thumbs up or thumbs down on that. When we have divided government, we end up with a situation in which usually we get stalemate, and governing itself becomes much harder, especially in the absence of compromise, about which, see what we were saying before about these two parties not very interested in compromise at this point.
Hmm. Our guest this hour, Charles Franklin, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's our guest for this morning's All Things Political. And we have, we don't have any open phone lines now, but hopefully we will soon, and we'll be looking forward to taking your phone call at 1-800-642 1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Your questions and comments about what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, maybe in the Middle East, or maybe in Japan. Whatever's on your mind, you can call us or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today for Kathleen Dunn for all things political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today at 12:30, Norman Gilliland reads from The Poisoner's Handbook by Deborah Bloom. That's 12:30's Chapter a Day. This hour, we're talking with Charles Franklin for All Things Political. Charles is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And a couple of emails here are questions from Kathy, who says, could your guest explain why it is that public employees are segregated from private employees in this debate? And are public employees exempt from property, income, and sales taxes? If so, I would love to hear about it. Well, that's one I haven't heard.
Well, I would love to be exempt, but alas, Kathy, I have to tell you, I do indeed have to pay all those taxes. So there's no exemption there. I think the simple answer to the division between public and private is that the state has the ability to regulate its relationships with its state employees and the unions there, whereas private employment is and unions in the private sector is governed by federal law, not by state law. So hence the distinction.
All right. Well, thank you for that email, Kathy. And on to Dan, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Dan.
Yes. I was on the sidelines for most of the last month here listening on WPRN and a lot of other sources for information. It seems to be a problem of just that, people not getting enough of information to make educated decisions on how to stand on this collective bargaining issue. And then until finally I was able to get a hold of a copy of the some of the union provisions on this collective bargaining from somebody who was a public employee and read through it. And I found out some of the strangest things that are in there, which is, you know, many of the reasons why Governor Walker wants to take these collective bargaining issues away, because it really is about money. There's a lot of provisions in there that make a fortune for we, the taxpayer. And the reason he's looking at it is because, you know, we, the taxpayer, are getting fed up. The conservative crowd out there are those who are probably been paying and paying and paying for years and years. They don't go to the polls and vote. They just keep the status quo, but I think there's a lot of them now that are learning that, you know, and I'll just read a couple of them here. You know, it starts out from some trivial things, but it gets to more serious things. Employers must provide bulletin boards to post information about union social and recreational activities. Size and location of the board is subject to collective bargaining. Minor thing, but, it, you know, why should employers have to spend the money to do these types of things when... Doesn't everybody have email? Can't they just receive a bulletin in the email and they read it that way? When a local union meets, the following conditions are subject to bargaining: the lighting, vision care and examinations, noise, chairs, desks, footrests, adjustable terminals and keyboards, work environment design from things like wallpaper, carpet, windows, and then room temperature. Another provision, starting of vehicles during cold weather is subject to collective bargaining.
So, Dan, you're really getting at the need for reform of unions, employees' unions. And do you think, Charles Franklin, that going the route to eliminate unions addresses sort of the issues that people like Dan see? Or do you think that there is a reform route that could follow as well?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd say that Dan bringing these issues up is a testament to the success of Governor Walker's public relations strategy, in the sense that the governor's office started putting out this list of horrible things out of contracts that Dan is citing that look like and are very detailed, nitty-gritty things that are contained in union contracts. And so the flow of that information out, and that it's being picked up by citizens like Dan, who become aware of it, and now it affects their views of the issue, is a great example of how public relations works within politics, and it's a success story that some people have now picked up on these things. From the union's point of view, the argument would be, Collective bargaining is a contract. It's a way in which we settle what can and cannot be done and how it should be done. And because it's mutually agreed upon in the end, it's legitimate in that way. And those of us who aren't lawyers aren't used to reading the picky details of contracts between workers and management or between companies, for that matter. But anybody who's been forced to read a contract knows just how minuscule the details are that are set out. So in that sense, there's nothing unusual about a union bargaining agreement that has lots of picayune-ish details. That's the core of any kind of contract that's written by well-qualified bargainers and attorneys. Now, in the bigger picture of things, how unions bargain, what kinds of things they get in their contracts, whether those are legitimate or not, what they may sue over. Milwaukee Public Teachers sued over access to Viagra recently, though they've since dropped that suit. Those are the kinds of things that I think a lot of non-union workers and supporters of the governor have been able to pick up on and use as examples of what they perceive or present as overreaching by unions. So there's a lot here on both sides, but you know, it's worth remembering that in Wisconsin now, less than 15% of the population of the employed population is a member of a union, and it's below that in the private sector. It's above that in the public sector, and that divide and how the nearly 85% of the employees in the state who are not represented by unions, how do they view this and how do they react to it? That's going to be the key to determining what happens in these recalls and what happens going forward. And Dan's quotes from these are just one element of how those opinions are going to be formed and the impact they'll have.
Professor Franklin, did you see this coming, this move to severely restrict unions in Wisconsin and nationally?
I'd have to say generally not. The key telegraphing of it was that Governor Christie in New Jersey was able to be very successful in challenging the teachers' union there, initially simply to take a wage freeze for a year. When the unions resisted it, Governor Christie, who's a Republican, newly elected Republican in 2009, used the teachers' union as a foil to argue why the state needed more control over its unions and so on. And so, and largely, he was successful in that effort. I think that was the telegraphing to GOP governors that unions could be used as a successful target, both because of their seeming intransigence and because of the perception that they were privileged in some way, as with better benefits, for example, which we've heard a lot about, especially retirement benefits and to some extent health care benefits here in the state. So I do think there was some telegraphing of that. The move to make it so much harder for unions to continue to exist, that was not something that I had seen coming from other states, though now we know, or at least I know, that a few other states had moved on this, including Indiana a few years ago.
I think we've got time for one more phone call here. David, with us from Plainfield. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Veronica.
Sure.
Your guest, Professor Franklin, with all due respect, you make it sound as if 2012 is right around the corner, and yet this governor has done so much damage and done so much to polarize this state in just a couple of months. And we're all led to believe that this is about unions and this is about teachers, but there's so much more language that has been put into this 140-page legislation, such as the Wisconsin taxpayers spending $9 million to upgrade our 37 power plants so they can turn around and be sold for $1 to be privatized. The president of We Energies was paid over $10 million last year in his salary. Where's the sense in all of this? And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Dan. And that's exactly right. We have been so caught up in the union aspects of this that there are a lot of other elements in the budget repair bill and going forward in the upcoming two-year budget that we're going to fight about. But let me just say, my view of this is about more than unions. It's about political power in the state, and it's about which party gets to make policy in the state. Republicans won that right in the 2010 elections, and you know, David can be understandably impatient for seeing some mid-course correction. I certainly get that for somebody on his side, but my slightly more relaxed view would be that this is a fight that's going to take place over a long period of time, rather than one that gets settled ultimately in the short term.
And I'm
so
sorry,
for that reason, I stress 2012.
We're out of time, but Professor Franklin, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Veronica.
It.
I enjoyed it.
Charles Franklin, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.